I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, we take a look at the continuing pandemic, this time from the angle of Great Britain, with Sean Ledwith, author of the new Counterfire article, Coronavirus: The Politics of Cummings Cull. If you're not familiar, Dominic Cummings is the rather eccentric chief advisor to Prime Minister Boris Johnson. And in the aforementioned article, Sean Ledwith lays out how Cummings and his quote-unquote super weirdos are facing potential resistance from the British public in an age of pandemic. Don't want to waste any time, and I'd like to jump right into the conversation with Sean Ledwith, a member of Counterfire and lecturer in history and sociology at York College, where he is also UCU branch secretary, and of course, the author of this fascinating new article we are going to be discussing, Coronavirus: The Politics of Cummings Cull. And with that being said, let's dive right in. Welcome to Parallax Views. Sean Ledwith, a member of the website Counterfire, and also author of the very fascinating new article, Coronavirus: The Politics of Cummings Cull. How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good. Very tense times right now, but working through it, and I guess it's given me a lot of time to do things like interviews and podcasts and writing, getting information out there for people. So maybe I'm trying to find a silver lining in all of this, but it is very anxious times.
Yeah, I mean, very, very scary times. But like I say, I think also an opportunity to do quite a lot of thinking and quite a lot of reading. And quite a lot of reflecting on, you know, what I think what we can already tell is going to be a hugely pivotal period in lots of respects.
Now, with regards to this article you've written, Coronavirus: The Politics of Cummings Cull, I think some people may not be familiar with the figure that you're referencing in the title, namely Dominic Cummings. Of course, he's involved with the administration of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, but his name has generally gone under the radar for many. Who is Dominic Cummings for those that are unfamiliar?
I think for US listeners, probably the best person I would compare him to is a sort of British version of Steve Bannon, a sort of alt-right ideologue who has managed to sort of inveigle his way into the sort of the highest echelons of power. So his official position is chief of staff, but I think he's really taken on a sort of wider role in the current Johnson government of really trying to steer the government in a particular ideological direction. So he's a fascinating figure because his role really requires him to stay behind the scenes and out of the headlines. But I think the current corona crisis has really thrust him right into it. I mean, particularly over the weekend. I mean, I wrote the article last week, but then over the weekend, these comments came to light in the Times newspaper that Cummings had apparently said at a cabinet briefing that, in effect, we need to let the coronavirus rip through the population. And if a few pensioners die, then too bad. Now this cause offers massive ripples and controversy in the British media, but not in the mainstream media, needless to say. It's only really on social media that this comment has come to light. So the government has denied it, but I think it really does reflect the particular ruthless and callous nature of this particular government. And it's really not out of character for Cummings, because he has a track record of coming out with some really cranky right-wing stuff. But I think that the consequences of this particular crisis are going to be devastating in an unprecedented way. So he's really in the spotlight now, I would say, in a way that he really didn't intend to be, in a way probably which Johnson himself would prefer Cummings not to be there. So like I say, I think a Steve Bannon, Svengali type figure, basically, for Johnson.
Oh, you mean for Cummings?
Yeah, Cummings as a sort of Steve Bannon type character in the Johnson government.
Okay, I see. You were saying I see what you meant. You were saying he's a Svengali-like figure for the Johnson government.
Yeah, that's right.
So I know you said he's a lot like a Steve Bannon figure. How would you sum up his sort of politics or ideology? Are there any like main bullet points? I know he has a really he has his own blog, and it's really long and arduous most of the time. He's a very odd figure.
Yeah, he's a really sort of difficult figure to get a handle on, because he really takes his inspiration from all over the political spectrum. You know, he'll quote Lenin, but then he'll talk about appalling sort of eugenics ideas. So he really's got a very sort of scattershot political ideology. I mean, think in the UK, the political debate before Corona was really dominated by the Brexit issue. That's really where Cummings made his name. So I think he first came to prominence on the sort of right-wing fringe in the sort of 90s, arguing against Britain's incorporation into the euro single currency. And then he sort of progressed onto a wider agenda of taking Britain out of the EU, but with a sort of Thatcherite agenda. I mean, probably most Americans might be familiar with him, because a couple of years ago, there was a TV movie called Brexit, The Uncivil War.
Yeah, I actually have been wanting to see that one. I forget who plays him in that movie. It was a major actor. Oh,
Benedict Cumberbatch, yeah. And yeah, it's definitely worth seeing. It's a remarkable performance. I think in some ways, you know, Cumberbatch is obviously a great actor, and he makes Cummings come across as a more attractive figure than he probably is in real life. But I mean, Cumberbatch does sort of bring home this sort of strange, dark charisma that Cummings has. I mean, the thing that makes him interesting is Cummings is quite upfront and brutal about he has a very low opinion of the traditional Tory and ruling class establishment. He makes various comments about how most British workers rightly don't trust the Tory party, and the Tory party, if given the chance, would savage the NHS. But then at the same time, he's quite happy, obviously, to serve the Tory party. So he gets a lot of sort of, I suppose, what you might call street cred by his uncompromising attacks on the Conservative Party, on his blog and in his sort of in his role outside government. That's obviously he's put a lid on that. But so he's got this sort of outsider profile that makes him a very interesting figure. But yeah, he does draw his ideology from a very strange range of ideas from all over the political spectrum. But I think that the key thing is his focus is always on what you might call an alt-right perspective, about really trying to undermine Britain's sort of traditional public sector ethos, health, education, welfare, etc. So sometimes he has some little strange progressive ideas about drawing upon people like Lenin. But overall, it's an appalling reactionary ideology that he is promoting.
And my understanding, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, I was reading a report that Cummings, in addition to being one of the sort of behind-the-scenes orchestrators of Brexit, he is also orchestrating Boris Johnson's messaging around coronavirus. I see that's a report in a website, The New European. Is this the case, that he is sort of one of the main people behind talk around coronavirus in the UK?
Yes, undoubtedly. I would say that Cummings is arguably the key person. I mean, the phrase that's become infamous already is the concept of herd immunity. A couple of weeks ago, the government gave a press conference on its general strategy regarding coronavirus, and Patrick Vallance, who is the chief scientific officer, he used this phrase herd immunity. That the basic idea was that the thinking then was to allow the virus to sweep through the population, probably affect 60 to 80%. And then the idea was that if there was a second outbreak later in the year, people infected would hopefully have some level of immunity. Now, straight away, I think the rest of the scientific establishment were appalled at this notion of herd immunity. And it was questioned on scientific grounds, but also on political grounds. You have to ask yourself, what sort of a government refers to its own population as a herd? So I think it's pretty clear that this sort of thinking does come from Cummings. And there's another interesting guy at the heart of the government operation at the moment, a guy called David Halpern, who I mentioned in the article. And he leads this organization called the Behavioral Insights Team, which is also part of the Downing Street team. And apparently, in one of the British tabloid newspapers last week, Cummings gave this guy a serious tongue lashing, if you're familiar with that phrase, for using the phrase herd immunity. So the phrase herd immunity has dropped out of government language over the past week or so. But clearly, in the first week, the corona crisis, from the government's viewpoint, it was really the foundation of their strategy. But the scientific establishment has really torpedoed the concept. I think that particularly important was a report from Imperial College London.
A lot of news here, actually, as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Imperial College London report suggested that if herd immunity remained the foundation of the strategy, it could cause up to a quarter of a million unnecessary deaths in the UK. So you've seen a rapid U-turn on the herd immunity strategy, and it's completely dropped out of government language. But I think it is consistent with Cummings. If you look at Cummings' blog, there's lots of nonsense about eugenics and a sort of a biological view of human intelligence. So it's an appalling phrase, but I think it's not out of character for Cummings, really, to have used that phrase in the past.
Also on that blog, he states that he's particularly interested in public health and the field of epidemiology, or the study of risk, which is interesting.
That's right, yeah. I mean, again, if you read it, he has a lot of stuff about humankind facing some sort of catastrophic crisis in the future. And of course, that in retrospect is quite prophetic. But of course, the irony is that the catastrophe that's now upon us is as much his handiwork as anything else. I mean, I think the case of various Far Eastern countries say that if you adopt a different strategy, you can certainly put a lid on this outbreak to a reasonable extent. But I think Cummings' sort of eugenic and biological approach to the whole thing is part of the reason why Britain is probably facing an oncoming calamity in the next few weeks.
Well, if we can, you mentioned BIT, Behavioral Insights Team, which is co-run by the Cabinet Office, and I guess it's a quote-unquote innovation charity named Nesta. And
yeah,
David Halpern is heading up BIT, and they're proponents of a theory called nudge theory. What is nudge theory? I know what it is because of figures in the U.S. who have pushed it, namely Cass Sunstein, who was involved in the Obama administration, and Richard Thaler, who co-wrote a book with Sunstein on nudge. But for my listeners that are unfamiliar, what is nudge?
Nudge really came to prominence in the UK around about 2010, when the Cameron government So Cameron was British Prime Minister from 2010, and he really initiated nudge theory in terms of British policy-making decision. And it's really based on the idea that the age of the big state was over and that people wouldn't respond to instructions from government anymore. So what policymakers have to do is instead of sending down instructions from above, they have to sort of nudge or coax people into doing things. Now, I think the sort of the unspoken aspect of the theory was a sort of a neoliberal premise that big government spending is out of date, and that we need to leave things to the free market. We need to leave things to people's rational choice. So I think nudge theory was a bit of a veneer for a sort of neoliberal approach to really stripping the heart out of the public sector and institutions like the state education and the NHS, and really putting the responsibility back onto individual people. So that was the sort of thinking of nudge theory. When Cameron was prime minister, for a few months, one of his big ideas, so-called, was this idea of the big society, which is this idea that he'd try and encourage British people to do a lot more voluntary work. So people running libraries, running pubs, things like that. But again, I think that was just really a smokescreen for actually stripping the funding out of things like libraries and community centres. So the big society, so-called, didn't last very long, only a few months in terms of the cabinet government. But the concept of nudge as an ideology is clearly back in thinking in sort of neoliberal circles. And I think it really does show up in terms of the government's approach to corona, because there's been a big focus on what we as individuals can do, and not really a huge amount on what the state will do for people. So lots of things about wash your hands and stay at home, which are obviously important, but really in themselves they're not going to have a massive impact on the situation. And again, I think states in the Far East, which have adopted a much more aggressive approach, and even some states in Western Europe, far more aggressive, but really based on the idea of exercising much more control from above, that's really been seen as really the way to deal with this crisis. And I think the fact that the UK and the US are looking like they're going to be particularly badly hit is not really coincidence, because, of course, these are two states that have really pioneered the whole ideology of neoliberalism since about the 1980s. So there's a sort of grim irony that our two countries are going to be particularly badly hit, I think.
Well, I want to note, as I said, nudge theory is not just something that has been used in Britain. As I point out, for my U.S. listeners, it's very popular with certain quote-unquote intellectuals. Like I said, here it was popularized by Cass Sunstein in the Obama administration. So this sort of has had, its big surge in terms of interest in it since, I would say, 2008, when the Sunstein book on it came out. And it's interesting to me because it's all based around behavioral science and behavioral economics. It's basically a theory within that realm. But I was recently reading in Vox, of all places, an article entitled "Why We Can't Always Be Nudged Into Changing Our Behavior," that says that recent studies looking at nudging mostly found disappointing results. I'm curious as to whether you think nudging is even effective. I get the impression that you think people are actually much smarter and can push back against this whole nudging thing and see through it to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot depends on people's perception of the state, really. I mean, I think in UK politics over the past decade or so, there's been a huge amount of distrust and cynicism of the state, going right back to the Iraq War, MPs' expenses, the whole sort of Brexit debacle. So I think people's willingness to believe politicians has been massively eroded over recent years. So the premise of nudge theory is that people won't believe politicians. So if politicians give them a sort of aggressive approach to a crisis like this, the argument from the nudge thinkers is that people will get fatigue. But I think the fallacy of that is that if people trust and respect their politicians, they will be willing to do whatever they are told. But I mean, Boris Johnson particularly has an appalling reputation as a liar and a charlatan and a cheat. So I think people's scepticism about what they've been told in this particular crisis is entirely justified. I mean, I think many people have pointed out that really in a monumental crisis like this, you couldn't really have a worse leader than Johnson, you know, a man who models his whole persona on a sort of light-hearted chumminess is really not the sort of person you want in a situation like this. So I think the failure of nudge theory is based on underestimating people's willingness to take advice from above. If the advice is perceived as based on genuine authority, people will take it. But if it comes from a person like Johnson, then people's willingness to believe that is going to be very limited.
In other words, the advice has to come from someone that we can fill a certain level of trust with.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. A person that people can connect with, a government that people have some sense of participation and ownership in. And I really think that, you know, this current government, which has really been in power since 2010, has really eviscerated British society on so many levels in terms of its attitude to the NHS, attitude to the welfare state. You know, this is the government that presided over the Grenfell disaster. So people have a huge amount of cynicism about politics. So I think when people like Johnson and his so-called scientific advisors appear in the evening at 5 p.m., a lot of people, I mean, there was a poll last week saying that, I mentioned in the article, only 36% of British people believe Johnson's advice. And then particularly now, in light of the fact that the government has so conspicuously abandoned herd immunity, you can't really expect people to accept one advice one week and then accept something totally different the next week.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I think before this all happened, people were trying to say, oh, see, no one really trusts the left in Britain because of Corbyn. And people are sort of saying that now in the U.S. with Bernie Sanders. But I don't get the impression people really trust the conservative parties much.
Totally, yeah. And of course, the irony is that the establishment and the Tory party particularly, in effect, has had to turn to the methods of the left to try and cope with this crisis. So you've had, over the last few days, a gigantic injection of public money into the economy to try and save the economy. And also the election, last British election, Jeremy Corbyn was talking about policies such as free broadband, which of course everyone regarded as, well, people on the right regarded as completely inappropriate. But now, I mean, most people in Britain this week and probably for the foreseeable future are increasingly working from home. So the idea of free broadband makes eminent sense to a lot of people. So I think one of the unfortunate realities of this situation, which is obviously not something the left can take any pleasure in, I think the opportunity for sort of an ideological reorientation is very real. The fact that the right has had to resort to the traditional messes of the left in order to try and get out of this situation really does give us some ideological possibilities once the situation is hopefully dealt with.
And getting back to nudge theory and Halpern and BIT, you mention in this article that you can look back at a questionnaire that I guess Halpern and his people devised in 2015 that had to do with Islamic radicalization. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and why you mention it in the article.
Yeah, I mentioned that because another aspect of government policy in terms of education is what's known as the PREVENT strategy. Now, this is supposedly to try and prevent British youth being radicalized by supposedly either extreme of the political spectrum. But in reality, PREVENT has tended to really to impact most on Britain's Muslim community. So the idea is that British Muslims who might be thinking of joining ISIS type organizations, PREVENT is supposed to find some way of intervening and deterring them from doing that. Now, of course, the context of this, which is never mentioned by the proponents of PREVENT, is that the British state is responsible for some of the most horrific foreign policy miscalculations in the Middle East. And the whole sort of overturning of the political situation in places like Iraq is fundamentally the responsibility of the British state. So, again, there's another fallacy of that particular intervention was this idea that Islamophobia or Islamization in the British Muslim community is sort of rooted in some sort of elemental hostility within the Islamic ideology. But there's no contextualization in the framework of British foreign policy, which for my viewpoint is really at the root of any radicalization that is going on in the British Muslim community. And as I mentioned in the article, I mean, not only do I think the whole sort of premises prevent is flawed, but in that particular intervention, the intervention was particularly crass. The school involved, I think that the senior leadership of the school were not even informed, and that these questionnaires were sent directly to the primary school pupils with no sort of permission. So it upset the parents, it upset the school management, it upset the local Muslim community. So it's a very sort of clumsy intervention. And again, I think that reflects on the whole sort of misconceived nature of the whole of nudge theory.
And you also note that Halpern gets a really extravagant amount of money as a government advisor. These people pushing neoliberalism and nudge theory are making a killing.
Yeah, it's quite scandalous, really. I mean, that's the thing, is that people at Halpern like to set up an image of being quite benign and quite well-intentioned. But then if you look at the extent to which he fills his pockets, sort of 200,000 a year, then I think you really see the true motivation of these people. I mean, I think another aspect to talk about, Joe, is that in the British discourse over the weekend, there's been a lot of criticism of British people going out in parks and at the beaches when, you know, the scientific advice is to stay indoors. But again, I think it reflects the mentality of the government of blaming individuals. I think there's a government spokesman today saying that basically, you know, people who are still going out are being selfish. Now, I think the irony of that is that a government that at its root is committed to selfishness as its core ideology, this idea of trying to turn the crisis around and blame us as individuals is just typical of the whole neoliberal ideology. There's been a lot of ambiguity and lack of clarity in government advice. So I think when people have ignored instructions, it's really because of a failure of the state to provide clear and trustworthy and authoritative information.
You know, it's interesting you mention that, because in the U.S., just last week, there were kids going out for spring break. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of blaming the individual, as you put it, in the U.S. as well, I think, with the coronavirus crisis. And yet, I think people forget, when all of this was first breaking in the U.S. and the U.K., we were being told, oh, this won't affect young people. Donald Trump was saying, oh, this isn't going to be a problem. And when you tell people that enough, I mean, what do we expect in a lot of ways? It's been very confusing and very contradictory.
That's right. Yeah, I think the Western states have really completely underestimated this particular crisis. I think there's been a lot of complacency. I mean, I think that the Far Eastern states have had the advantage of similar epidemics in the past, things like SARS and MERS, and that's given them a bit of an advantage. But I think the British states, the Western states, have been completely negligent in not learning the lessons of those sort of outbreaks. And like you say, I think a sort of arrogance to assume that when this problem emerged at the end of last year, a sort of assumption that it would be another sort of Far Eastern problem. So they've really been caught out by a complete failure to really follow the lessons of what's happened in the Far East over recent years. And a sort of an arrogance and a hubris, which again, I think is all part of the whole neoliberal agenda, really.
And also you mentioned two other figures here that I'm not as familiar with, Chris Witty and Patrick Vallance, and some statements they have made that really show the just level of ineptitude at hand.
That's right, yeah. I mean, originally the government strategy was to present these two as objective, neutral scientific authorities. So Witty is the chief medical officer and Vallance is the chief scientific officer. So originally Johnson's strategy was to allow those two to sort of do the talking at press conferences. But again, those two were very, very much bought into the sort of the herd mentality concept. And also this idea that the British public would fatigue if you gave them over-intrusive instructions. But again, I think the thing that hopefully might have saved a lot of lives in the UK was this report from the Imperial College London, which basically torpedoed the whole herd immunity notion. So, I mean, I think any right thinking person would think that those two particularly should have been fired, really, and Cummings as well. But that they're still there. So I think, you know, we've got the problem that many people have in Western states is you really have a sort of an elite that's cut off from reality. And even when they make transparent U-turns and transparent retreats, it's very difficult to hold them accountable. I'm sure that a sort of a political reckoning will come for all the people at the heart of this disaster, really.
And also, I guess one of the things they've been trying to do in the early stages of the crisis, I don't know how long this is going to last, this ability to make this excuse, but there's this idea, and they're saying they have, you know, behavioral research to back it up, that people in the UK and the US, they're not going to be able to comply with the kind of restrictions. Oftentimes, people say they're very draconian restrictions that have been applied in China. And yet, you know, whatever you want to say about China, it seems as if the restrictions have gotten things under a level of control that Western states have not gotten them under. But they're claiming that no, the US and the UK couldn't possibly do that. The people here couldn't possibly abide by those restrictions.
Yeah, again, and I think that probably we're now in a situation where you could think you best compare to wartime. Well, it's probably the biggest socio-economic crisis since World War II. Because the reality is that the British public, along with the US public, were quite willing to withstand major restrictions on their sort of movements and their activity in the name of what they regarded as a good cause. So again, I think the notion that people won't respond to authority, it all depends on what is the nature of the authority. If people feel that the cause is a necessary one and that the voice that is bringing the message is one that they can trust and respect, I think the government has massively underestimated people's willingness to accept instructions. But again, you know, from my viewpoint, this is not a government that people can have trust and faith in. But I think the notion that people would not trust any authority is just a fallacy. And again, I think, you know, World War II, where you had a government with significant figures of the left involved, people did respond to that. But I think this government is seen as much more of an ideologically pure one in an unfortunate way. And I think that explains why people's possible reluctance to take advice springs from that. And I think, you know, if we had a different government, to put it bluntly, I think you probably would see higher levels of public cooperation. But as I say, I mean, Johnson has really made a career out of being a liar and a cheat and a charlatan.
Well, so, I mean, he's a man of mindless catchphrases. I mean, I remember when I first heard him say, "Take back control." And I'm just like, this guy is an oafish clown. And he's from a very posh university, but he sort of acts like he's this oafish everyman in some ways. It's bizarro.
That's right. I mean, you know, there is an expression that people get the leadership they deserve, which I don't think is true. But you can partly see how the Johnson does personify really the worst elements of the British ruling class. You know, he's got a long track record of racism, misogyny, ignorance, and a general sort of buffoonish persona, which does reflect a certain sort of reckless element of the British ruling class. So he has made a career out of that absurdity. And again, I think in a situation like this, you really need a person of gravity and seriousness and respect, which he conspicuously isn't.
He's also, I remember he's made comments before about social mobility or one's place in the sort of economic pecking order in our society as being very much linked to things like IQ and genetics. And I didn't realize this, but that's apparently also very true of Dominic Cummings. He also believes that. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. If you read Cummings's blog, there's lots of stuff about how, according to him, people underestimate the effect of genetics on intelligence. And earlier this year, I mentioned in the article that Cummings put out a call for what he called super weirdos to join the government. And this guy called Andrew Sabisky joined the government. And as it turned out, it didn't last very long because there was such a political stink, he was sort of thrown out. But this is a guy who's on record of saying things like, if we have any sort of trial medication, if it means one dead kid, it's worth the price. And he's very much a follower of, someone that you might be familiar with in the US, Charles Murray's sort of eugenicist agenda.
I'm familiar with Murray, and I am not a fan at all. It's funny, I've been mentioning Murray because here everyone is talking about universal basic income now, especially in light of this crisis and the possibility of using it to damper some of the economic situation here. And I've said to people, I'm like, remember, Charles Murray has been a proponent of UBI. And the reason for that is maybe after this crisis, they could normalize UBI and just cut the welfare programs. I mean, there's sort of a scheme going on here, and people like Murray are behind that. And of course, Murray wrote about IQ and race with his book, The Bell Curve. So yeah, I'm very familiar.
That's right. I mean, I think when this crisis is abated slightly, there will be a huge ideological battle, and obviously the right is not going to completely concede the ground. And I think you're right. People like Murray will try and use UBI as a sort, maybe some way of trying to relaunch the right ideology. I mean, I think neoliberalism itself is going to have a massive sort of crisis of identity over this, because it's apparent that really sort of assertive state action is really the only way to deal with this. And of course, if you commit to an ideology of laissez-faire and nudge theory and all that sort of stuff, you're really leaving yourself hugely exposed to this sort of crisis. But it's interesting because as a sociology teacher, I was talking to my students about Murray just before Christmas, and they were all saying, oh, what a ridiculous idea. Surely no one takes that seriously. And then within a matter of days, a guy who was on record as agreeing with Murray found himself at the heart of government. So I think it was a bit of a wake-up call for people that these sort of new right ideas, unfortunately, are not just on the fringes. You know, increasingly, thanks to the likes of Cummings and Steve Bannon, these ideas are really at the heart of power now.
So what is, maybe you could just reiterate the story of Andrew Sabisky, one of these super weirdos that Cummings called for the need for government decision making. Who is this and how long did he last in government?
So just before Christmas, Cummings put out this call for super weirdos to join the British Civil Service. And again, I think it reflects Cummings' sort of persona as a bit of a maverick and a bit of an outlier, that he likes to present himself as having a sort of clash with the traditional British civil service.
So almost like maybe you'll get this reference, maybe you won't, but almost like a Colin Wilson character, the outsider, you know?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm very familiar with that. Yeah. So Sabitsky came from one of these alt-right think tanks. And as I say, he's on record with some pretty repellent sort of stuff about, very similar to Murray's talk about so-called IQ tests proving that black children have inferior intelligence to white children. So Cummings gave this guy a job as a special advisor in Downing Street. But then within a matter of hours, the press got hold of this story. And of course, inevitably, anyone who gets a position in government, their social media thread is minutely analysed. So all these horrific comments from Sabisky came to light. So I think it lasted less than 24 hours. But I think that the revealing thing is that Cummings initially regarded this guy as appropriate and acceptable. And really, you know, if the press hadn't done their homework, he probably would still be there. But, you know, from my viewpoint, people like we mentioned earlier, people like Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance are not really that different, because, you know, Sabitsky didn't last 24 hours and didn't cause any harm. But those two individuals, potentially they're going to be responsible for hundreds and thousands of deaths, if we don't get a lucky break over the next few weeks. So from my viewpoint, they're just as crackpot weirdos as Sabitsky is.
And Sabitsky, I believe, actually said you know, when it came to the issue of trialing for new medications, he said it's probably worth a dead kid once a year. I mean, yeah. this is a very frightening sort of character. The fact that he could even get that far is shocking.
That's right. And of course, it's got echoes of what Cummings allegedly said a few days ago, that if a few pensioners die because of corona, too bad. There's really no differentiation between all these comments. They're all equally horrific. And I think it really does show how far the British ruling class has lurched, that people like this are now got their hands on the levers of power. And unfortunately, you know, to a large extent, we're all at their mercy at the moment.
It's interesting. I was just reading an article, and I think it was by a blogger, Isabel Frey, and they basically summed it up in their article headline. They said, herd immunity is epidemiological neoliberalism. That's sort of what this is.
Yeah, I saw that. It was a wonderful phrase. I think the other ideology behind it, really, if you go back even further, is sort of Malthusianism, really. This idea that the lower classes, so-called, you know, they really need to be culled. So, you know, we went for the title of the article, Cummings as Cull. And I think, unfortunately, it's proved to be spot on. This really is an attempt to cull the British population.
It's interesting, though. I feel like certain rich people, especially ones fleeing to places like New Zealand now, are very scared about coronavirus. And I wonder if the increased focus on this is because they know that this can get them too.
That's right. Again, you know, I think the obviously everyone's focused on the biology and the epidemiology of this situation. But again, I think the political fallout will be massive, really. I mean, I was reading about in your part of the world how a lot of the rich have been fleeing to, is it the Hamptons, a sort of rich, mm-hmm. Area that people tend to head to. And again, I think I was reading a lot of opposition in that particular area to those people. So I think you will see a real surge of sort of class hatred, basically. I mean, there's a well-known sort of so-called entrepreneur over here called Richard Branson, and he's laid off all about 8,000 of his workers, I think. And again, people have contrasted that sort of misanthropic response to that. I think one of the impressive things is that, you know, a sort of community level at street level has been a really impressive response from people. And I think a lot of people have said that when this crisis abates, you will see a major sort of cultural shift. Again, it might seem quite trite, but more kindness, more consideration, more civility. So they're all sort of potential positive outcomes. But also a real sort of resentment of people like Branson, and like you say, the sort of people who are flying off in private jets to the corners of the world to escape this. I think there'll be a real sort of political backlash against those sorts of people.
I know right now there's a real fear amongst certain thinkers and people who comment on politics that this whole coronavirus business, this pandemic, could lead to further resurgences in nationalism after it's all said and done, more fuel for the sort of fringe right, which is quickly becoming the mainstream right. What do you make of that? Do you think there's any silver lining? Do you think the doom and gloom may be a little bit too early to call?
Yeah, I think that the left has to sort of fall back on its traditional values of things like internationalism. I mean, it seems clear to me that in this sort of situation, the only salvation is a sort of global response and a sort of coordinated response. So I noticed that Slavoj Zizek, we can have some eccentric ideas, but I think he made a good point a couple of weeks back that, in fact, this whole situation really makes a powerful case for a revival of the whole concept of global communism. You really need a coordinated global response to this sort of situation, where all the different states of the world sort of pool their research, adopt similar policies, I mean, you know, the case of the Chinese sending their doctors to Italy, I think, is a really an inspiring case of global cooperation. And so I think there are some ways in which you need to focus on the positives that can come out of this. And I think also, again, this might be something that might be more appropriate in your context. I think that the notion of science itself, I think, hopefully might be get a sort of political revival, because obviously in the US, science itself can sometimes be a contentious idea. But again, I think many people might actually see that, again, in these sort of situations, science is really the only way you can get out of these situations. But again, science under a sort of democratic control, rather than, again, in the case of the two British scientists who have come up with herd immunity, which is obviously a completely flawed idea. But again, a sort of a science that serves the population and the global population is an idea that, you know, I think hopefully should be a source of inspiration in the future, and maybe lead to, you know, more young people, more students seeing science as something they really want to get involved in.
I think, too, that it's been very heartening news, like Cuba welcoming I believe it was a British cruise ship with people that had COVID-19. And they said, no, come in. They were completely altruistic. And I think it's showing that the sort of, individualism first, there is no society type mentality of a lot of Western countries is not the way to go, especially with a crisis.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think it's quite understandable that people succumb to despair and a sort of a sense of dread in this situation. But I think there are some real authentic examples of inspiring action. I think the places like Italy and Spain, where I think at a certain point of time in the evening, everyone sort of comes out on their balconies and applauds the nurses and the doctors. Again, I think that shows a real awareness of a sort of a mutual and a collective identity, which, like, you know, like I say, can completely supersede really the sort of the individualism that has really got us into this mess.
I would go farther. It's not just individualism. It's just straight up barbarism at this point.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think at the end of the article, I paraphrase Rosa Luxemburg. I think we're really in a socialism or barbarism 2020 scenario. This really is a threat of unprecedented scale for the entire human race. And the only way to tackle it is to really evolve a sort of a collective consciousness based on those at the bottom of society who have really been impacted the most. So that sort of traditional left internationalism and solidarity and sense of a collective response really is something that hopefully will persevere and survive after this.
Before we wrap up, I just have to ask you about, well, here in the U.S., I'm already starting to see this is all China's fault. It's all China's fault. Or just talk of the virus itself rather than how neoliberal policies have really led to a lot of the problems. In a way, it's not even the virus that we should be worried about so much as the fact that we don't have enough hospital beds in the ICUs. And why is that? It's because of these policies that have been placed in for 40 years that are creating a crisis. I mean, if we had the beds, my understanding is this would be much less of an issue.
That's true, yeah. And I think one of the unfortunate aspects from our perspective is that this crisis has really overlapped with a bit of a political vacuum in the UK, because the Labour Party, the party of the left, where you traditionally expect that sort of critical analysis to come from, and unfortunately is going through a very sort of inward phase where they're trying to choose their leader after Corbyn. So Corbyn is making those sort of comments that really need to be flagged up a bit more. So from our viewpoint, it is unfortunate that we don't have that sort of high profile voice. But I'm sure that, again, when the crisis abates, those sorts of hard figures will be looked at. But again, unfortunately, another unfortunate aspect for us is that I think our mainstream press, particularly the BBC, have really failed even by their low standards. There's been a real lack of evaluation and sort of critical analysis of the of of the government approach and a real sort of reluctance to criticise the government. Where I think in a situation like this, people's ability to criticise the government should really be there, but it's not coming through at the moment. Partly because of this unfortunate timing with the Labour leadership, but also because of this rather sort of supine attitude of the mainstream media.
And with regards to, I mentioned the sort of blaming China. I'll preface this by saying, you know, people can argue all day about, oh, China's too draconian, or they can argue, oh, China, it broke out in China, therefore it's China's fault. But ultimately, this is not a time for great power politics. I mean, people think that Trump is the only one that's aggressive towards China. That's not true. It's DC consensus to be aggressive towards China. There's cosmetic differences between the DC consensus and Trump, but as I said, cosmetic. I don't think it's the time to be blaming China. I think we need a coordinated global cooperative effort to deal with this right now, regardless what one thinks of China.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's very interesting because I've heard very few people actually blaming China for this situation. I think most of the negative feeling in the UK has really been directed at our government for its complacency, its negligence, its sort of slow reaction. And I think people have noted the fact that China has sent its doctors to Italy. People have noted that China, as soon as China identified the virus, they released the required research material to scientists around the world. So I think, yeah, that sort of Sinophobia, I suppose you'd call it, is there, but it's not as prominent as you might fear, actually. I think most of the hostility is being aimed at our government.
Do you think that, I guess the concern that I hear people having is, well, if we take up the approach that China had in this, won't that affect our freedoms? What about our freedoms? How would you respond to that? Because to me, this is a crisis. This is a matter of life and death of, you know, what could be millions of people. So I think in this case, extreme measures are very much needed.
Yeah, I agree. China is not the sort of state you want to look to as a model of politics. But in terms of its response to this crisis, you'd have to say it's completely spot on. I think that what we would look for on the left is a sort of decisive state intervention, but a state that is under regular and routine democratic accountability. Of course, you've got the situation of the doctor in China who alerted the authorities to the virus, I think maybe in November or early December, and the state unfortunately tried to sort of gag him, basically. So there is that aspect of Chinese policy which has backfired. But like we're talking about on fatigue, I think people will respond to instructions if they feel it's coming from a state or an authority where they've got some degree of participation and some degree of control, which doesn't exist in China and realistically doesn't exist in the West as well. So I think what the left has got to provide is a model of a state that in a disastrous situation can take decisive action, but can also be accountable, can also have a degree of political participation and authentic democracy, really.
I always like to try to end on a positive note. I've been hard pressed to do that lately. As you point out, 36% of British people believe Team Johnson's corona advice, and only 36%. So the rest are saying, no. They're fighting back against, as you put it, and as Cummings puts it, the super weirdos. Anything else you would say on a more positive note to wrap up this convo?
Something I've already said, really, but I think it's worth underlining. I find it very difficult to imagine how neoliberalism can recover from this. So it's not the way we would have liked to deliver a death blow, but I do think that the idea that the market, that keeping the state out of society is the best approach is virtually dead as an ideology. And I really do think that on a massive scale, people are going to see that. So that's something I would regard as a positive that's going to come out of this. Again, I might be underestimating it, but I would hope that this is banging the nail in the coffin of neoliberalism.
Well, I have to say, I really hope after all of this is said and done, and I do believe we will make it through this, but after it's all said and done, I hope that people will be more questioning of the blind idiot god of the market, so to speak. I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. I highly recommend everyone check out your article, Coronavirus, The Politics of Cummings Call, on counterfire.org. How can my listeners read your work? Do you have any social media? Just how can my listeners engage with you?
Yes, if you go to the bottom of the article, I write for various other websites, so there's plenty of links to my other articles. That's probably the best way for people to follow my view on things. But, you know, I would recommend the whole Counterfire website. I think, you know, all the people who write for Counterfire really have a very finely tuned and well-orientated political analysis of Corona, but also, you know, the wider questions that, again, we'll have to return to in the future.
Well, thank you again, Sean Ledwith, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you, Joe. My pleasure.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I should note that this conversation was recorded just hours before the UK had an announcement from Boris Johnson announcing tighter restrictions on travel. I hope the British people are doing as well as they can in this time of pandemic. And I thank Sean Ledwith of Counterfire, a really great website, for taking time to come on the program. As always, you can reach me on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Additionally, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon. Should have some bonus content up by the end of this week. Of course, I am not expecting many new Patreon supporters due to the financially difficult times many find themselves in. So if you cannot support me on Patreon, no harm, no foul. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax J. Michael. Views to Parallax with J. Parallax Michael. Views with J. Parallax Michael.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.